And good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Human beings have always been at risk for acquiring infectious diseases from animals. Well, it's also true that diseases can go the other way as well, as human beings continue to encroach on the habitat of wild animals. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll try to take a look at some of the complex ways in which humans and other animals are affected when they share habitat and they pass infectious agents between species. And our guest for the program is Matt Allender. He is a wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist. He is now visiting instructor in the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine, here where he got his degree. We're really pleased that he could come and spend a little bit of time talking with us this morning about the subject, and particularly as we try to look at not so much the way that infectious disease gets passed from non-human animals to humans, but how that also can go the other way. And apparently we're seeing more and more of that. So questions certainly welcome as we talk. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We also have email if you'd like to send in a question that way. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate that. I guess we should mention, in addition to the fact that you do have this specialty in wildlife veterinary practice, that you do also see domestic animals as well, some of that kind of work.
Well, yeah. So at the vet school, I have a wide range of activities. So I do have a main interest in wildlife epidemiology, so the trends in disease that occur in wildlife. But that also translates to clinical patients that I see. And I was in small animal practice seeing dogs and cats in Urbana for a couple of years prior to doing my becoming board certified in zoo work. And so now I concentrate on clinical zoo patients. So it's non-traditional stuff.
Okay. So I guess the thing that we're talking about here, the technical term for this is zoonosis, which means essentially diseases being passed back and forth between different species.
Yeah, and zoonosis is typically a sign from when a disease goes from an animal to a person, but anthroponosis is diseases that go from people back to animals. So anthropozoonosis is the interaction between both diseases. So it's kind of technical, but pretty much it's just diseases. It's just health. It's just like when we go to the doctor. It's the exact same diseases that we're talking about. Yeah.
So as far as diseases that come from non-human animals to humans, as far as we know, this is something that has been going on. Who knows for how long, but I think that it's the case that we can take many human diseases now, infectious diseases, and say that either we know or that we have good reason to believe that those were things that did jump species and that started in non-human animals.
Yeah, I would think that there are several of those things that are around us every day that we're well aware of, things like salmonella for foodborne pathogens can go from domestic animals to people through the food chain. It can go from reptiles to people through handling are definitely examples of the zoonoses that occur. And yes, I would imagine that diseases have been passed back and forth between humans and non-human animals from the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. So,
and I'm sure that would have been the case during the point where humans had contact because of hunting and just because of living in the environment with wild animals. But I would imagine that a new wrinkle in this whole process came at the point where, wherever that was, where we started having domestic animals, and then we actually lived closely with those animals in a way that we did not live closely with wild animals.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I think, you know, diseases have evolved just like all animals on Earth at some point, and that diseases involved in the environment are have always been affecting humans and non-human animals, and that we've all been a source, that environment has been the source of the infection. But when domestic animals and humans came into more contact, think about an office building at work, and think about during flu season, being in that office building, you have more of a chance of getting sick. Think of that as the environment as well. When you put animals and humans in closer contact, that there's more chance of getting infection. Does it guarantee infection? Not always. There's no guarantees in medicine, but it definitely, if you look at it through that analogy, you can see why you would get more diseases.
Yeah.
And as we translate that into wildlife, as urban environments have started to sprawl out and wildlife habitats have started to decrease, then those animals that have been in that environment are in smaller and smaller areas. And so, again, if you take the office space type of analogy, those animals then are closer and have more of a chance of getting sick. And so it's very similar to all the things that we're used to thinking about. It's just thinking about it in a little bit different way.
So for those diseases that seem to have jumped from domestic animals to humans, were those something that actually originated in the wild, moved from wild animals to domestic animals, then from domestic animals to humans?
No, I think that they're each one of each disease, each pathogen, each bad bug is have a different story. So I think it would be hard to say for sure, but there are certain diseases. Such as salmonella. Let's go back to that. That in reptiles, it doesn't cause any problems. That it lives in salmonella, or lives in reptiles. It colonizes their GI tract. They live in perfect harmony for the most part and don't cause any problems. It's shed naturally, but in humans or in primates or in dogs or in anything else that we're seeing, it definitely causes GI problems. In things like tuberculosis, which is a major human disease that also affects our non-human primates and can affect birds. It can affect other mammals as well. That's one of those diseases that probably didn't originate from domestic animals in that pattern. It was probably significantly more complex.
Yeah. Well, is this something that we are starting to see more of? I guess I'm thinking primarily here of diseases that we see in humans, but we can also talk about the anthroponosis, the ones where it goes the other way. Is that something that we're actually seeing more of?
There's a lot of epidemiologists that are looking at that, from the CDC to just about to here in Champaign-Urbana, from faculty here that are looking at that. And our detection methods are definitely better. And so the question always arises, are we seeing it more because it's more prevalent, or are we seeing it more because we're looking better, or that we have better glasses to see it in? And that's still hard. That's a hard thing to know. There are definitely emerging diseases that were less prevalent 10 years ago than they are today. And those diseases are increasing in number and increasing in scope. One of those diseases is something that we recently found in snakes in Illinois called Chrysosporium. It's a disease that affects people. It can affect people typically that are immunocompromised. And we now are seeing it in snakes that are possibly immunocompromised as well, but are completely free-ranging and in the wild. And and so that's a disease that, or at least a species of snake that we've been monitoring for over 10 years and never have seen any evidence of this disease. And then it popped up just about 3 years ago, and we've been kind of dealing with it ever since. And emerging diseases are scary. They're scary for people. Things like avian influenza that we've heard so much about that, you know, has reservoirs in wild bird populations or in chicken factories or various other places can affect humans or cross species. Things like Chrysosporium as well, but the interesting thing about emerging diseases is that it can definitely decimate populations or cause epidemics or outbreaks in people, and that's why it's so scary. And we come back to the fact that we all live in this environment together. Wildlife, domestic animals, humans, we're all in this environment together. And when there's diseases that are innately in the environment, wildlife are just as susceptible to get it as people are to get it from the same source. And that's what's important probably about the Chrysosporium is that this is a soil-based fungus that the snakes got. It's soil-based, and that's how those snakes got it, but it's soil-based, and so that, you know, people are, or dogs, or cats, or deer are just as in that same environment. And the questions come, well, why do some animals or why do some people get it and why don't others? And it comes back to the health of the environment, the health of an individual, the immune system. That plays the same way for people that it does for dogs and cats.
Mm. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Matt Allender. He's a wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist. He's visiting instructor in the College of Vet Medicine here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the health of wildlife, ecosystem health, and human health, and about how all of those things are connected. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. This Chrysosporium, this is a fungal infection?
It is
that
yes.
Right? Now, the thing here that seems particularly interesting is that now you have found this in a particular kind of rattlesnake in southern Illinois and in the wild. But the thing that's interesting is that it's apparently something that you hadn't seen in snakes in the wild, but it's something that you had seen before in domestic reptiles that people were keeping as pets.
Yeah, so to clarify that, the yes, reptiles for pets, we've seen Chrysosporium. Yeah. We have, there have been various researchers across the country that have seen isolated cases in wild snakes. Mm-hmm. This isn't the first case in a wild snake. But because there's not that many people looking or the effects on the population haven't been so dramatic as to notice, it's not been one of those things that's been reported well. But yes, this is a disease that, again, is ubiquitous in the environment. So that it's not surprising that there are reports, when you Google Chrysosporium for people, that there are reports for Chrysosporium in people that date back several years. Mm-hmm. This pathogen has been around for several years and it's been in the environment. And so, this is one of those examples that we're all in this together that, we're not one necessarily particular group of or demographic of animals or people are necessarily more susceptible or more of a reservoir or carrier host. We're all equally can get disease.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess maybe I was misunderstanding that possibly the idea was that this was something that mostly you saw in domestic reptiles and that somehow it had moved from there out into the environment. But what you're saying is that, well, no, we're thinking pretty much it's been in the environment. So I suppose then the question is, well, if it seems that suddenly you're now seeing wild snakes with this infection, the infectious agent had been there, but it didn't seem to be affecting them before, or at least we didn't see it, then what has changed that results in now the fact that you're starting to see it in these snakes where you pretty much hadn't seen it before?
Yeah, I think that is the logical next question and the one that we've had as well. To emphasize that, the reason I think that we've seen it in people and in pet reptiles is because we see more of those. There's every day how many million doctor's appointments for people and how many, thousands of appointments for reptiles across the country that mm-hmm. the numbers you just are going to see more. Do we see Chrysosporium more in pet reptiles than we do, let's say, in pet rabbits? Of course, it's not even close. Astronomical. So reptiles may be particularly sensitive to it in general. But what's the reason that we've seen it in these wild snakes, these rattlesnakes now, and we didn't see it 10 years ago is what's changed is a great question. And so there are either two possible scenarios that are likely is either that pathogen just got introduced to that environment within the last couple of years. And so it's a novel pathogen in the environment. So the snakes don't have a natural immune system to it. And so then they succumb to disease and die. Or it's, as you said, has always been there. What's changed in the environment? And so, or what's changed with the snakes? And so this population of snakes is the largest population of Massasaugas in the state, the only one that possibly has any chance of long-term survival in the state. But its population has been shrinking dramatically due to, you know, suburbanization, urbanization, or agriculture practices, which are all extremely necessary in portions of the society. And so, but whether or not those are having a direct effect. And so one of the things that we've looked at this past year were heavy metals that were in the snakes and whether or not they're accumulating metals that from the environment. So from things like batteries or things, metals that have been deposited in landfills or in the environment, you know, could those be having an effect? And we know that in people, lead paint and lead-based products in general cause a suppression of the immune system, especially in children. We see that exact same thing in all animals, and including reptiles. And so we've been looking at lead, we've been looking at zinc, we've been looking at, you know, lots of other metals to see if those metals in the last couple of years are elevated above what we would expect them to be. And if they are, if then that could be causing the immune suppression that leads to these fungal infections happening. There are other things that could be leading to it. You know, there are other things in the environment that we're doing, whether or not it's changing the water flow patterns of a particular area so that things are sitting more in wetlands, or there's more water in wetlands and there's not allowed to dry out. Desiccation can kill lots of different bugs, and whether or not that's not being allowed to happen, or if there are pesticides or compounds that are getting into the water system that are, again, weakening the immune system. And you know, as someone that's lived in Central Illinois just about my entire life, you know, this is concerning for me and my kids as well, that we, you know, if these things are in the environment and are affecting animals that live in the environment, is this something that could affect me and my kids in our water system as well? And so this is why I think this is important. This is why I continue to do it, and I get kind of excited about trying it.
Yeah. Is this something, this infection, is this potentially life-threatening for the snakes?
It is definitely life-threatening. Right. In fact, we've had 6 cases so far, and all 6 have died.
And is this something that you're also, now I believe it's true that it has been seen in snakes in other parts of the country. Is this something that affects other, and you, I know you're particularly interested in various kinds of reptiles, turtles,
sure,
and things. Is this something that you also see you have seen in other species?
It's been in other species, but this past couple of weeks since the release of the report has come out, I've gotten inundated with several requests and several other biologists, mainly from the Northeast, in timber rattlesnakes. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't necessarily, I haven't necessarily been told about other cases of Chrysosporium in mammals or in amphibians as of yet. I wouldn't be surprised at some point if we have those cases, but or if those cases have occurred in the past. But I've gotten reports from Massachusetts, New Hampshire, as well as New Jersey just within the last couple of weeks that this is happening. And I've had individuals from Michigan that are starting, that would like to start to look for this pathogen because they see the link and they see the importance to not only wildlife populations, but to potentially a bigger audience as well. And the population in Southern Illinois, when we've had 6 die, the population is estimated in this one area to be barely over 50 to 75 animals. And so when you start to lose 12 to 15% of the population due to a wildlife disease, that's something that population is not going to be able to recover from. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about extinction, local extinction at the population level. And that's not something we talk about with wildlife diseases very often. I mean, wildlife diseases are typically in healthy populations of animals, just like in healthy populations of people. Diseases don't typically play a major role. Infectious diseases don't play a typical role in overall mortality. It has a low grade mortality, of course, due to, you know, various things based on age and other factors that we see with animals too. But when it starts to affect 10 to 15, 20% of a population, that's quite concerning. And population declines due to fungus have not been unheard of, especially recently. They have been well publicized for wildlife. Things like the chytrid fungus for amphibians will cause population declines across the entire world. It's been seen on nearly every continent, and especially in Central and South America, it will decimate frog populations and cause local extinction. things like white nose syndrome in bats. Mm-hmm. That's another fungus. And in fact, that fungus is not that far different from the Chrysosporium that we're seeing. But that has caused mortalities of over 2 million bats now within the last couple of years that the new report just came out. And the Chrysosporium, while it's not well studied, we don't know the effect on overall populations like we're getting to understand it in white nose syndrome. But that's exactly what the next step should be.
So what if you for the local environment, for the ecosystem there in Southern Illinois where these snakes live, supposing that we just took them right out?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of impact would that have?
Well, it's hard to say. So obviously, all animals play a role in the ecosystem, whether it's through predation or as a source of prey, a protein source, biomass, as part of the food web, various other things. It's hard to say. So it would only be speculation. Mm-hmm. And so, but I mean, obviously, things. If snakes are their main food source are rodents, and then that impetus was gone and rodents didn't have a natural predator in the environment, rodents would increase. And then we know about the well-known effects that rodents can decimate on agricultural practices, especially locally, but also on the transmission of human diseases. So, that would be a very dramatic type of example, but and would take a couple of leaps to get there, but that could be a possible sequelae. It's also possible that other populations of non-native snakes would take over those habitats and would take over those habitats and fill that ecological niche. But then the diversity in that population decreases. And as diversity of the population decreases, they're more prone to extinction through catastrophic events of certain things, so like diseases. So in this case, the Massasauga population, where as the population numbers start to decrease, they're more prone because they're closer, but they also have less diversity, meaning less diversity in their immune function. They have less opportunity to recover from these extinction events or these infectious diseases. So if they go away, then the next population may take over, but then the environment has less diversity, and then the environment is more prone to decreasing its capacity to handle changes. Mm. And so there are so many different things that can affect the ecosystem and the environment, and that one little kind of hairpin will start to unravel.
Okay. We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Someone who is calling from Watsika. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. A very interesting program. Wanted to draw a comparison correlation, if I may. I had an interesting program on NPR yesterday about the origins of HIV virus and more or less how it had remained not necessarily dormant but isolated in Africa for about 100 years until industrialization and travel and the development, all these kinds of things led to its worldwide spread. And I was wondering if the doctor would think there'd be any sort of correlation. You hear these stories about poachers or people stealing, exotic birds from Africa or South America or fish, bringing them over here and vice versa for sale. And I'm just wondering if that whole illegal industry could have a very detrimental effect as far as diseases from animals and to animals on a worldwide basis. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you. That is, in fact, a concern, that illegal trade in exotic animals, moving animals around, just increases that possibility for greater contact between the animals and humans and then the introduction of disease.
Yeah, and that's kind of been I thank you for the question that and comment, because that's exactly what we've been talking about, and I think it does highlight it well that the world is becoming smaller because of transportation and it's a corollary with this population becoming smaller, but the world becomes smaller if there's increased contact and things like HIV for sure. But there are other diseases that have been well known to be transmitted through transportation. Things that within the last decade, like West Nile virus, that is typically, again, from the West Nile, from Africa, from the Middle East. And, in 1999, it showed up and diagnosed coincidentally by a zoo veterinarian in New York for the first time, and then it spread across the country and is still causing problems. That things like heartwater disease, which is a disease that affects cattle, especially and especially detrimental to the cattle industry, has come over on ticks that have been from imported animals imported through Florida. So there was just a report actually there's a link on the National Wildlife Health Center's website, and this is through the USGS, that talked about the disease potential and the diseases that were actually identified from local confiscations at major airports in the U.S. And that the major industry, and this I just heard that this is over a $5 billion industry, this illegal animal trade, and that it definitely leads to many diseases. And so we're talking about a few isolated diseases here. But what's scary is that there are so many other diseases we haven't even diagnosed yet. We haven't even seen because, you know, in the outskirts of Africa, Asia, where, you know, North America even, where animals have adapted to certain diseases over thousands and thousands of years so that they're not affected. When those animals are transported out of their environment, or if they're put into an environment that's unhealthy, where they're more likely to transmit the disease or break with the disease, that's when we start to see these emergence of all these other diseases. And so I think the caller had it right on, that this is definitely a concern. I don't believe that's what's going on with the Chrysosporium. I think that's different, but it's definitely can be made the corollary for many diseases from animals and humans.
Yeah, well, certainly it is true. The case that the caller cites, at least we believe that it is the case with HIV, that began as an infection in primates in Africa, and that it was there for who knows how long, but it was contained, and that people were exposed to the animals through hunting. And then as people did that more and people moved into places that they didn't live before, and then it was easier for people to move around and pass the infection around, then we saw it move aggressively into the human population. So that, again, is one of these cases that says people encroaching on wildlife habitat where they hadn't really been before, and the increasing mobility of people of various kinds of disease vectors, whether we're talking about people or non-human animals, that just creates that sort of pathway for diseases to emerge, that it's not like they come out of nowhere, but they're there and they're contained until the right conditions come along for them to move out of wherever it is that they have been.
Right. And as we, you know, we hear more and more about wildlife diseases, they become more mainstream mainly because of their prevalence. They're occurring more often, and because, you know, we're not being necessarily all that great for the environment. We're having periods where we're degrading the environment through numerous practices so. You know, what's exciting, though, is that conservation efforts or efforts to bring together all of the societal stakeholders are making actual improvements in certain areas in order to improve the environment for people, which also happens to improve the environment for animals. So this is an extremely optimistic, enthusiastic time. It's not very, you know, it's not the you know, the dreadful type, you know, the end of the world thing. This is exciting. We're recognizing these diseases. We're understanding the importance. And as we have more and more information, we can actually be empowered to actually do something. And again, locally, these are things that are of interest to me. I'm interested in numerous things across the world and have research interests in several countries. But locally, I feel that we have all of the resources here to actually make a difference and be a model for other places. So mm-hmm. We have lots of opportunities.
We're talking this morning in this hour with Matt Allender. He is a visiting instructor in the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I, where he went to school. He's a wildlife vet and epidemiologist, and we're talking about connections between wildlife health, ecosystem health, and human health. And we'll take some more, including a caller here. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents Every Revolution Has Its Square, Politicizing the Unequal City, with Eric Swingadow on Thursday, March 1st at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll have some Illinois history for you. We'll be talking with Gillum Ferguson. He's an independent historian, and we will talk about a book that he's written that looks at what was happening in Illinois. This was actually before Illinois was a state. It was then called the Illinois Territory. What was happening in this part of the country during the time of the War of 1812. Not a lot of decisive battles fought here, but he said that period was certainly very important in creating the possibility of the future state of Illinois. So he'll be with us in hour two. Tomorrow we'll have two archives for you. In the first hour, it's some conversation about the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. We'll be talking about a book that's titled Eisenhower, The White House Years. This was a show that we first ran in January. And then going back to last November, an interview with Andrew Feinstein. He's a former member of the South African Parliament. He's a writer. And back then, last November, we discussed his book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. And then we'll be back here live on Thursday. Let me just also mention that Thursday this week is our monthly show on computers, something that we do on a regular basis here to help you out. If you got computer problems, you can call in Thursday at 11. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. And you can also listen to past programs that way. In this hour of focus, we're talking with Matt Allender. He is a wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist. He's also currently a visiting instructor in the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. And we're talking about the connections between the ecosystem, its health, the health of wild animals, and human health. And questions are welcome. We have a caller here in Savoy. We will get right to the number, by the way, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And here's a caller on line one. Hello.
Good morning. I've got two or three quickies here. I'm reasonably sympathetic to the idea of the balance of nature, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know, and perhaps you know, what are rattlesnakes good for?
Well, as we kind of already discussed, and thanks for the question, is that, you know, All animals form part of the ecosystem, and I would be naive if I knew what the great plan was for all animals in the world. So I think that each animal has its unique function and its unique purpose in life. I think that's well beyond me to have established that, but that locally they form part of an environment, they form part of diversity within a specific ecosystem. They are a source as a predator in the environment to control populations of animals through their predation. They can also be a source of food for other animals that can predate upon them.
Who can eat rattlesnakes?
Great blue herons can actually eat rattlesnakes and have quite frequently. They're out west. There are skunks or badgers or various other animals that will also eat rattlesnakes. Rattlesnakes can also eat other snakes. So the populations and the interactions are really quite diverse. So
okay.
I'd
like to move on.
Sure.
You possibly know more about this than I do. I am concerned that perhaps part of the change in the ecosystem is the pharmaceutical companies continuing to sell antibiotics to farmers. And could that contribute to changes that, my memory is that most antibiotics, at least in the beginning, came from fungi anyway. So could this have something to do with some of the out-in-nature fungi becoming more infectious?
I would just be speculating. It would be. I don't believe that there's any information that or any data out there that indicates that. And I think that several of because of the press on this, and there have been several veterinarians involved across the country, that there have been significant improvements in the way antibiotics are used in agriculture settings. And while, you know, the same concern, though, there are still more antibiotics that are prescribed by for people than you would think locally for most of the domestic animals. Especially through agriculture. So and typically antibiotics are released down the drain in people as well as for domestic animals, and those lead to a stream somewhere, or those lead to some sort of reservoir. And they're all of those antibiotics, if they're not degraded by the environment, can definitely lead to changes within the microbial population, so the bacterial populations, fungal populations that are in the wild. And, of course, those can then link to animal diseases. And so I think that there's quite a few steps, and this process is complex. I mean, you know, that's one of the problems with talking about disease, you know, even for people, health disease, is that, you know, there are no silver bullets out there, and there is no easy pathway that is easy to understand. It's complex, but yes, for sure those things can happen, but there are multiple steps that need to take place first.
Certainly not many silver bullets. I want to ask, do you know anything about the Asian carp?
Obviously I'm aware of the entrance of the Asian carp into the Great Lakes system, as well as zebra mussels, sea lampreys, lots of non-native species. And specifically about the Asian carp, I'm not sure what your question will be. But
well, let me hit to it, and that is I was hoping you might have some insight as to why this thing wasn't stopped down just north of Memphis, you know, why they waited. You know, now it's had a chance to make it up the Ohio. It's up the Mississippi. Probably has started to move through the Missouri. These people that have been continuously elected to Congress don't seem to have any ability except to figure out how to get elected. And this would include the government employees for the great federal government. I mean, this thing could have been stopped. Much further downstream, in my opinion. What do you think of my opinion?
Well, I think you bring up a couple of interesting points that deserve some discussion. I think you might be overestimating the ability for things to happen quickly at any level.
It's been 3 years at least.
These animals are extremely able to elude capture, and it's not difficult. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to remove just the Asian carps from a complex ecosystem without damaging other portions of the ecosystem. And so, while I believe that Fish and Wildlife, have led to some of the bureaucracies have been involved in some of the bureaucracies that slow things down, that's just life, and that's what we're dealing with. But I think that they've been actively involved and actively engaged in trying to figure out solutions that will have the least impact on the environment and have the most benefit to removing the Asian carp. And I would definitely bring this along with the zebra mussels. There has been significant opposition this week and last week to for large ships that are traveling transatlantically to remove ballast water that they've picked up in Europe or in Africa and remove and eliminate it before it gets to ports in the United States, because that's how zebra mussels started. And zebra mussels now have wiped out many populations of invertebrates that form the filter of the Great Lakes. That is the basis of the Great Lakes. And
Yes.
So they
should have been having to discharge their ballast water deep out into the ocean in that area where very little things can live, and then pick up new ballast water. That should have happened. And
you're right.
I'll go back to saying how brilliant these people are that work for the federal government and we elect to Congress. Well, thank you, sir.
I really appreciate your call, and I think that you emphasize an important point that wildlife diseases, we can't live in a bubble. It's not a bubble, and that active conservation requires, you know, a small group of people that are energetic, but it requires research and it requires policy. And you have to have people that are understanding the science. And scientists, including veterinarians, are not often good about communicating why these things are important and that they're complex issues. And so they're not something that can be put on the back of a cereal box quite easily. And so it is complex. And we just need to do a better job for those of us that care of communicating and to policymakers, but as well as to everyone that's interested.
Am I remembering right also that the zebra mussel, there was an issue with zebra mussel being carrier of a particular disease? Is it salmonella, or am
I misremembering
that?
They can also do things like Purkinsis, which is a foodborne disease, but it also decimates populations of other invertebrates. And zebra mussel has been one of the, a contributor to population declines of invertebrates within the entire Mississippi and Ohio River Valley. In fact, in Ohio, there are more endangered bivalves and invertebrates than there are of any of the other species combined.
All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I had something about the antibiotics, but first I'd like to comment on the Asian carp. Controlling it after the flooding had permitted us to enter the Mississippi would seem to me have been much too late to think about this. The question to me is, why were they permitted to import these fish? And I would suspect part of it was the insistence of part of the voting citizenry that the government not over-regulate. But that's just my opinion. Recently, it was announced that a Staph bacteria had been discovered, which had been genetically altered. And it appears to have occurred in cattle that were being treated with antibiotic. The Staph is now what's sometimes referred to as a super bug. It is resistant to antibiotics. I believe this is the first time this has been definitely observed.
Well, thank you for your comments for sure. There have been several instances, and this is why antibiotics in people is such a hot topic. Is that antibiotics in people have constantly evolved, or bacteria have constantly evolved to become antibiotic resistant without even considering the effect of agriculture industry, which. At times, in some studies, it's quite minimal, the impact of agriculture. Really, the bacteria that are in human health are the same bacteria that we'll see for agriculture, same bacteria that you'll see for your dog and cat, same bacteria that we'll see for wildlife. They're all the same. But bacteria that are transmitted from people to people and develop resistance because of antibiotic overuse in the medical profession, human medical profession, is more likely to be transmitted from people to people than it would be from cattle to people. And that just makes sense. I mean, it's just more likely to be involved. But when we try to tie it back to wildlife and the ecosystem, is that, you know, these superbugs are in the environment and able to cause disease in everything that lives in the environment, whether that's, you know, ourselves, whether that's our pets, or whether that's the raccoons and possums and cardinals and robins that are sitting outside. You know, they're all have, if they're living in the environment, they have a susceptibility, a potential susceptibility. And again, most of those animals and most of those people don't necessarily. It's not where 100% of, you know, people are going to get this and have disease. you know, diseases we don't see that way, because there's so many complex factors that associated with your immune system, your diet, your genetics, that all play a role in the immune system. That's exactly what we're talking about for wildlife as well, is that, you know, wildlife are have all those complex factors. And why are we seeing some of these emerging diseases? It's because some of those factors are being influenced. And whether it's the immune system or whether it's genetics, because the populations are shrinking, so that the animals that are left, there are less of them, so there's less diversity in genetics. And so the ones that are left maybe are more susceptible to certain diseases. Same thing happens with animal diseases. Same thing actually happens with plant diseases and monoculture of plant diseases. So, you know, we think about, you know, we try to put things in nice boxes, you know, where it's just human health. We think it's just domestic animal health and just wildlife health. But really, if we start to look at those each as microcosms of the environment, and that the environment has all of these characteristics, then it's easier to explain a lot of the phenomena that we're seeing with health and with our environment.
Yes, that's very true. And the effect of feeding prophylactically antibiotics to cattle is probably going to have minimal effect upon wildlife, because we're not treating wildlife with antibiotics.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that I agree and 100% with that statement. Is that, you know, domestic animals especially live in and around wildlife. How many, you know, talk to how many farmers that you know, and I know, that deer have been seen within cattle feedlots, or within the raccoons or birds, and birds are not stationary. They're not going to come in and, you know, be right there. They're going to take whatever is on their feet or whatever they eat, and they're going to move. Same thing with raccoons, or same thing with deer, have, you know, 50-mile radius. So I would argue that we're all extremely interrelated, and that deer that went to that feedlot could easily go to your backyard and go to your bird feeder. And then that bird feeder will then feed birds, and those birds would go to the next bird feeder. And then you're going to go out there and change the bird feeder, and you're going to be interacting with the stuff that the birds let. So it's like Kevin Bacon, the 7 degrees of separation, is that there's actually quite a bit less separation between all of these factors, and we should start thinking of them together, that all of this has an impact on what we do, and that we may not see the impact, because when we eat something and get sick, we don't necessarily see or associate that sickness may then have gotten into the environment, affected a seagull somewhere at a landfill or somewhere else, and then that seagull will transmit it to the water system, and that water system will come back to our system where we drink and we get sick again. You know, we don't necessarily see those connections because they're difficult, and they can take several years and tens of years to occur. But we're in this together, and it makes it such an important topic.
Well, I think your point is very well taken, but I think the contention that there's no point in feeding animals antibiotics to prevent disease when sanitation and other measures would perhaps be more effective, and it would not be apt to increase the danger of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
No, I agree with that point for sure. That I think this is where significant trends and improvements have been made in the agricultural industry, directed by, in several cases, veterinarians were involved. Where, you know, you just like when people, you want it, for veterinarians, we want to treat sick animals. We don't necessarily want to give healthy animals anything that they don't need. Putting something in an animal can have negative effects. Just like when you know, I put my 7-year-old on antibiotics for an ear infection, he may go to the bathroom quite a bit more often. That has negative effects on his body system. Just like that'll happen with animals as well. And so as veterinarians, our first oath is do no harm. And so by following that practice, of course, you don't want to give an animal any medication, whether it's an antibiotic, you know, an antifungal, an antiviral, unless they need it.
Mm-hmm. We're down to the point where we have maybe 3-4 minutes left. I'm just curious about something. You know, we talked particularly in the first part of the show about some of this work that you had been involved in, looking at a particular kind of rattlesnake in southern part of Illinois that was endangered, and that you were seeing this increased in incidence of a particular kind of fungal infection affecting that was life-threatening, could kill the snake, and that it was something that it was caused by a fungus that was in the environment. So it had been there, but that it seemed for some reason that the snakes were more susceptible, or perhaps their immune systems just weren't working as well as they should be to fight off that infection. And then from there, the question is, well, you know, what's going on? And one could speculate about a number of things that might affect their immune system functioning. You might speculate about things, alterations in the environment that maybe made it more favorable for the fungus. So, you know, you can talk about a number of things that one way or another you could trace back to some kind of human activity. That would be an end result, would have the environmental impact. Now, having said all that, I guess I am just curious about, are there cases, have there been cases where a human disease does manage to pass the other, make the jump the other way, and you actually see a human disease, something moving from humans to non-human animals?
Sure. So things, and there are probably several, my memory is not bringing me to all of them or my studies thus far, but that one of the big ones that you would think of would be something called a herpes, even like herpes simplex, where in people, herpes simplex is pretty benign, innocuous, causes some cold sores in the mouth and various other things. Mm-hmm. But in non-human primates in South America, it causes death. It causes death and mortality, the exact same virus. So, so there are definite instances where a benign disease in people will cause massive mortality in other species.
Yeah.
So there are numerous different examples that have occurred throughout history, but that's the one that would probably be most, you know, readily apparent to most people.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it is the case. We talked about the fact that diseases can jump species, and you can have something that can be a particular species can tolerate that, but then when it jumps into another species, you see it can be potentially fatal. So we certainly have seen diseases go from non-human animals to humans, and that there are, I was just wondering about that. Yes, indeed. So their answer is yes. There are things that have the potential, and in fact have gone the other way.
Yeah, and things that have gone from, and we've talked about it, from domestic animals to wild animals. One of the big examples that I'll lead now with is toxoplasma, is a parasite that, a protozoan parasite, mm-hmm. that it is naturally unaffected in cats. And so this is one of the major reasons why pregnant women are not supposed to change litter boxes, is because of toxoplasma. It can cause birth defects. But toxoplasma is in cats. It's in litter boxes. Those litter boxes get deposited into the environment. And it's been shown that through getting into the water, it's actually caused population declines in sea otters in California, because it's getting into the waterway. And you'd think a protozoan parasite, something that you requires a microscope at high view to even look at, something that affects people as well, is actually affecting a sea otter and causing death in sea otters as well. Mm. So there are numerous instances.
There, you know, we've got to stop because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Matt Allender. He's a wildlife vet and epidemiologist. He's now working as visiting instructor in the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I, where he went to school. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.